May it please the court. This case arises out of a real estate investment program called Premier 72 that went bankrupt in October of 2001. The features of the investments were, in some cases, misrepresented, and in other cases, investors were not informed that the properties they invested in were in default. As a result of these fraud-related convictions, Ted Murray was sentenced to 20 years in prison. The sentencing in this case is rife with error. If I could, I would like to focus on issue two, the loss calculation, and then, time permitting, go on to the leader-organizer enhancement and the ex post facto issue.
Okay, let me ask you this. It looked like the government called an expert witness at trial that set the losses, in his opinion, at $84 million, and that's what the judge locked in on. So why wasn't the judge entitled to use that figure?
Well, first of all, the judge began with the incorrect figure, $165 million, and that is the figure that the judge mentioned when she pronounced sentence. So that $165 million figure never really left, even though the judge agreed, because the parties were agreed, to reduce the amount from 165 to 84. In her mind, and when she was sentencing Mr. Murray, the figure was 165.
Well, even if the judge started off at the wrong place, if you got the right bottom line, why is that error?
Because we didn't get to the right bottom line.
Okay. Answer me, why wasn't he entitled to take the expert's opinion? That was evidence in the trial. Why wasn't he entitled to rely on that?
Because there were things that were missing from that figure that were not accounted for. First of all, that the source of that figure, the documents that the expert relied upon, they're not part of the record. The PSR said that it used a figure that it gleaned from various accounting records. We don't have all of the loan documents to assess their true value and other source documents we would need to know what the right figure would be. But we also have a problem in that there was no testimony that all of the investments were misrepresented. So that $84 million figure very likely contains loans that were actually not fraudulent.
Yeah, we've got an expert who says that he reviewed all of the documents, and even though maybe some of the backup documents are not in the record, he was subject to cross-examination, and this is the figure he came up with.
Interestingly, Your Honor, the court has confronted this. In every other loss case that I rely on, the government has had an expert saying that the loss is whatever the loss the government contends is the loss. That doesn't mean that it's the correct amount just because the expert said it. And in fact, in OLIS, I believe Chief Judge Jones made a note about this. The defendants are not put on notice that the trial testimony from the government expert would be relied upon at sentencing for the loss figure. And so things like things that caused loss that were extrinsic to the fraud were not fully explored. So when you're cross-examining someone at trial, you're not necessarily cross-examining them for the amount of loss that would be used at sentencing. So there's a lot of cross-examination that could have taken place had we known in advance that number would be relied upon as the amount of loss. And interestingly, the number that of fixed losses that the expert said was $28 million. And then what he did is he added on loans that were outstanding. And that figure can't be the right figure because it doesn't include a credit for the value of those loans. No one testified that those loans were worthless. In fact, the government conceded at sentencing they weren't worthless. The issue was whether Mr. Murray deserved to get a credit against his loss for the value of those loans. And the court's holdings are very clear that he does. Under Goss, he's entitled to get credit for those. So at a minimum, even assuming 165 is the correct starting figure, 84 is not the correct result.
Well, when you have a disputed figure, I mean, you know, we have disputed figures all the time. Who's to say which one is the correct figure? I mean, you know, that's what the judge is there for, to resolve disputed issues, and he apparently thought this was the best, most reliable figure he could latch on to.
Actually, that's not what the judge said. The judge never said anything about the figure being reliable. What the judge did is the $165 million figure, which is, as I said, where we began with, yielded a sentence range of life. And so to avoid a sentencing range of life, the district court acquiesced in the party's agreement to credit Mr. Murray for the amount of loss. The judge never said that that was a good figure or a reliable figure.
Even though he didn't say it, apparently there was an agreement reached, or at least he agreed to drop down his original estimate, and that figure is supported.
By what exactly?
By the expert's testimony.
There's got to be more than just his say-so that that is the number. We have to look at the source documents. This court has made clear that the methodology is very important, and the fact that the district court concluded it is not sufficient to uphold it on appeal.
The rules give the judge a lot of flexibility in fixing the amount of the loss, and if you've got an expert opinion who says, I've looked at all the documents, and this is what I think the loss is, and I don't understand why that doesn't support what the judge came up with.
Because it didn't do it in Goss, it didn't do it in Olis, and it didn't do it in Klein. All those cases had experts and that the district court relied upon. And in each case, the methodology was incorrect. Under Goss, this case, the methodology cannot be supported. There has to be, at a minimum, credit for the value of the investments under Goss.
Well,
the
expert said he gave credit.
No. There were outstanding loans that $84 million, and I don't think the government would dispute this, that $84 million constitutes properties that had not yet been sold. And in fact, up until a few months ago, properties had been sold. It's a continuing process. Those properties had value, and even though it wasn't realized until later, that value should have been credited.
Well, he assessed $17 million as a likely future loss and deducted that to arrive at the $84 million.
Right, but the $84 million includes loans that are not necessarily fraudulent. It includes outstanding properties that haven't been sold off yet and were considered a loss.
You're saying that some of these loans were not considered fraudulent? Didn't the jury find that this was a Ponzi scheme and there was no legitimate business here, was there?
Actually, that's completely untrue, Your Honor. I'm glad you asked me that question. Although the government did posit that there was a Ponzi scheme, there was no jury finding that there was a Ponzi scheme. It was a mail fraud. It was a conspiracy. It was a securities fraud case. There's no Ponzi scheme mentioned in the jury instructions, and the jury never found that. The word Ponzi scheme was used by the government's expert, but again, that doesn't make it so. The entire business was legitimate but misrepresented. There were real loans being made. There were people making money. There were properties that were sold. This couldn't have been done if it were a true Ponzi scheme. In fact, the Supreme Court has defined Ponzi as something where there is little or no legitimate business. And that's on Cunningham versus Brown. That's Charles Ponzi's case.
The judge wasn't entitled to look at this as a Ponzi scheme where he was taking money from investors and using that money to pay other investors?
No, because in order for it to be a Ponzi scheme, there has to be little or no legitimate business activity, and that was not the case here. The government wouldn't dispute that there was no legitimate business activity. There were real investments. There were real properties that people were invested in. There were partnerships that were formed that investors were placed in, and those properties were developed and sold. It would be impossible for the presidential partners post-bankruptcy to have gotten together and sold all these properties and made $50 million if there was no there. It speaks for itself. So it's a loose term to use Ponzi and apply it to this
case.
Well,
to the extent, if you call a Ponzi scheme one where somebody takes money from one investor and gives it to another to pay off so-called interest, he uses the capital from one investor to pay another, an earlier investor, I mean, that certainly sounds like a Ponzi scheme.
Well, without the no real investments part, it can't be. It's just a simple fraud. And that's not something we dispute. Obviously, he was convicted of fraud. But what the judge did in labeling this a Ponzi scheme was the court felt that it relieved the court of any responsibility to do the case-by-case, property-by-property analysis that Goss requires. And it doesn't, because there was a true business. And regardless of whether you call it a Ponzi scheme or you call it a fraud, it is undisputed that these properties had value and that needed to be accounted for. And it's a lot of hard work. I don't blame the judge for not wanting to engage in that analysis, but Goss requires it. And not only is it Goss, but it's application note 2E2i, that requires a credit. That's what Goss is based on.
Did the defendant put on an expert about how much he thought the loss was?
There was no expert. I don't believe there was no expert provided by the defendant, but there was a competing figure provided, and that was $28 million. And that was based on the fixed losses, as Dennis Arney, the government's expert, testified. In addition to no credit for properties that had value, there is a further lack of credit for, or lack of accounting of, market conditions and world events. This is an actual loss case, meaning that the defendant is only held responsible for the reasonably foreseeable pecuniary harm resulting from the offense. And there are factors at play here that are extrinsic to the offense. For example, 9/11 occurred 3 weeks before Premier declared bankruptcy.
Of course, all that assumed this was a legitimate business.
I don't think there's any doubt that there was business going on.
Yeah.
We would have to look and tease that out. How much of this is a bad business decision as opposed to a fraud? How much of this is precipitated by 9/11, where there was David Lapin, one of the defendants, testified that there was a run on the bank that precipitated the decline of Premier and the bankruptcy. And furthermore, part of what caused a lot of these defaults, that certainly there were bad business decisions, loans were made to people who had no ability to pay them back, but aside from the fraud, there was a bad business decision such as those, and there was also declining real estate conditions in the Houston economy with the bursting of the dot-com bubble in 2000, and that's right when this business was taking off. So there certainly are factors that should have been considered that the district court indicated it would not consider and was not obligated to consider. And again, relying on Dennis Arney's testimony that this was a Ponzi scheme, the court said that it didn't have to sort that all out. But that's contrary to this court's decision in Olis. You have to separate out what is the fraud and what is all the other things that caused the decline of the investment.
But in Olis, there was evidence, though, that the loss wasn't, that some of the loss was as a result of the market. Is there anything like that in this record?
Well, the timing overlaps to some extent. So the same market forces that would have pressed down a stock certainly can press down real estate investments and investments in general.
But was there a testimony to quantify how much it would have?
No, there wasn't, but that is not the defendant's burden. The defendant's burden is to demonstrate that there is error on appeal, and then it's the government's burden to show that that error is harmless, which is made much more difficult after this court's decision in Ibarra Luna that indicates that that harmless error burden is a very, very high one. And the government can't make that showing here. Just briefly, the government's argument in its papers regarding the court only needing to provide a quote-unquote reasonable estimate of the loss doesn't apply on appeal until we have ascertained that the methodology is correct. And for the reasons I outlined, it is not correct in this case. So the court should not even look to whether it's a reasonable estimate before confronting all these errors committed by the district court. And very briefly, as to the leader organizer, this case is controlled by this court's decision in United States versus Ronning, which indicated that there has to be control by the defendant of another participant in the criminal offense in order to be eligible for the enhancement. And there's no evidence, although Mr. Murray held a high position in the company, there's no evidence that he actually supervised or controlled anyone. He had his sphere of the business, which was the mortgage side. Mr. Lapin had his sphere of the business, which was the investor side. And Mr. Lapin supervised Mr. Wigginton, the only other criminal participant. So Mr. Murray did not actually supervise anyone and thus is ineligible for the enhancement under 3B1.1. For all the reasons that I've outlined, this court should vacate Mr. Murray's sentence and remand for resentencing consistent with Goss, Olis, and Klein.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lando. You saved some time for rebuttal. Mr. Gilbert. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I must start with saying that the United States strongly disagrees with many of the factual assertions made by the counsel for appellate. As to the point of the loss, the $165 million figure, the Court is correct that the judge correctly found that amount was accurate. It was stated in the PSR. The record shows that the judge accepted the PSR.
I see the government didn't rely on the expert's testimony for the $84 million. At least I didn't see that in the brief.
Well, Your Honor, it was stated during the sentencing that even though the PSR accurately collected and found the $165 million loss, the United States did not object to accept the expert's opinion as to an $84 million loss. And that figure is easily arrived at, the 84, subtracting the $50 million that we actually gave credit to the defendant for. These were the amounts of, if you will, losses that were saved or returned by the investors who took over the partnerships after the company failed. That's $50 million off the 165. That leaves 115. The United States also gave the defendant, if you will, credit for the additional $17 million, which the Court has already acknowledged, which were hard losses that testimony showed would never be recovered. In addition, the $28 million, which brought us down to approximately $87 million. The expert, Mr. Arney, also acknowledged another $5 million that was recovered by co-defendant Lapin. So that brings it down to $84 million. So the point is that the defendant has been given considerable leniency, if you will, or credit for the work of the investors, that is the return of the $50 million that they received after they took over the partnerships, the $17 million, which could never be returned again, and the $28 million hard losses. So our position is that the Court correctly accepted, even though the Court acknowledges that she found that the loss was $165 million, she acknowledged and she accepted the figure we used, that was $84 million. So we think that's consistent with the case law, that Mr. Murray has been given more than ample credit. And as to the point of appellate this morning, that the Court should have considered the value of the outstanding loans as of the time of the trial. Well, in fact, the analysis I just gave you does that. But as to the $84 million, that was more than a gift. And there was no evidence that, and this is another point we disagree on, that there was ever really any legitimate business that this defendant pursued. If it pleased the Court, the evidence showed that this was a Ponzi scheme, because although there were properties bought with the investors' money, there was never any money put into this company, this scheme, by any of the defendants. Further, Mr. Arney, the expert, testified that for every year in the PSR, starting with 1998-99, and the merger came between these companies in 99, this scheme, this program ran a loss every year. There was never a year of any profits by any performing loans. Mr. Arney also pointed out that out of some 92 loans, only 15% did not completely default or were foreclosed on. In other words, as the Court knows, and we point out in our brief, the so-called interest that was paid to investors was simply the money taken from new investors given to old investors. And so even though the defendants, including Mr. Murray, set this up so that it would appear to be a legitimate business, our position is it never was a legitimate business, and it was a Ponzi scheme. Therefore, the Court accurately found that the loss of the outstanding loans at the time of the bankruptcy was $165 million, and that was more than accurate. It was accurate, and the Court gave the defendant considerable credit by actually acknowledging the loss at $84 million.
What is a Ponzi scheme? I mean, is there a definition that the Court has given this term?
Well, I think appellant counsel this morning correctly cited from the Ponzi case. The Supreme Court said that it was where you only have money coming in from investors and you don't have any apparent legitimate business. Charles Ponzi set that scheme up so that it appeared that there was some legitimate business, and so did Ted Murray. That's precisely our point. So to the extent that there were any outstanding partnerships which had collateral, which were attached to the investments, the collateral bought with the money from investors, and then the investors came in and did a great job in taking over these partnerships to try to save money, that should not be given, you might say, credit to Mr. Murray. In fact, the case law in the circuit suggests that, particularly with the, one of the cases point out that even though Mr. Murray is given some credit for restitution purposes, for the amount that the investors were able to earn, you might say, or save, the $50 million, that should not be counted for loss purposes. There's a distinction there. And our position is that the $165 million finding of loss by the court was accurate and appropriate.
How do you distinguish Goss?
Well, Your Honor, again, Goss, to the extent that there was any collateral, that credit was already given to Mr. Credit in this $165 million figure. And again, through the figures that we just went through, the money that the investors got back and any value to the property that they received was adequately reflected in the $84 million figure that Mr. Arney, the expert, found and the court accepted.
Did Mr. Arney, was there a written report by?
There was.
Was that made available to the defendants?
Yes, Your Honor. It was made available. It was made prior to trial. And we respectfully disagree with another statement this morning by counsel that the defendant was put on adequate notice that Mr. Arney would testify. And his report was given. And all these figures were not a surprise. As to the second point made by counsel this morning, that is Mr. Murray's position as a leader and organizer, we again respectfully disagree with counsel and would point to the record that Mr. Murray was not only the person who organized Premier along with Mr. Lapin. Mr. Murray had a 63.9% interest as reflected in the PSR. Further, that Mr. Murray was a lawyer and he had this business up and running prior to the creation of Premier. Now, where the fraud really comes in and the extent of Mr. Murray's culpability, even though we, counsel for Mr. Murray would say that he was not supervising anyone, this was an extensive criminal activity. So under 3B1.1, we think that the leader and organizer role and application was appropriate. And that is to say, this was an elaborate investment scheme set up by Mr. Murray. When Mr. Lapin and Wigginton first joined Mr. Murray, before they merged, Mr. Murray was only doing residential mortgages. The trouble comes in where Mr. Murray, even prior to telling Mr. Lapin, he begins to use the funds from the Lapin Investment Company to fund commercial loans. That's where he got in trouble with securities. And when you take more than one investor to fund a loan for a commercial loan that would exceed the investment of the one investor, it becomes a security. Mr. Lapin testified that he didn't know that Mr. Murray had started making these commercial loans until they merged in 1999. Excuse me. They'd already been doing business at that time, prior to that, under a joint venture agreement. But Mr. Murray never told Mr. Lapin that he was beginning to fund commercial loans. Mr. Lapin was under the impression he was still funding only residential loans, which was a basis for them coming together. So even in January of 99, when there was a merger, Mr. Murray had already funded some 28 commercial loans, all with a negative balance. That is, none of these loans were performing. And that's key to this case because the government's position is that none of these loans were really adequately performing. Giving him credit for the 15% that the expert found, which the developers and the borrowers made work, if you will, it still doesn't let Mr. Murray off the hook. Because Mr. Murray made these loans, and Mr. Lapin further testified that at the point that he found out about the commercial loans, he then found out, unknown to him before, Mr. Murray was taking a 25% fee off the top of these loans, going to the borrowers. Mr. Lapin had no idea of that. It was not his agreement. So these are simply facts to point out how Mr. Murray was the leader and organizer in the scheme. Further, that Mr. Murray solicited investors from Texas and Arizona. We point out in our brief some of the investors, like Vince Coleman and even Tiger Woods was approached. Mr. Murray went on trips to do that. Mr. Murray knew about the loans and defaults before anybody else. This is reflected in the record at 4033. And that is where Mr. Lapin testifies that Mr. Murray, the way this was set up, when the two companies came together, Lapin and Wigington on one hand and money mortgaged by Mr. Murray on the other, the right hand, if you will, they tried to keep this Chinese wall, didn't know what the other hand, the other side was doing. But nevertheless, it was Mr. Murray who brought in the borrowers, made the loans to subprime borrowers, and none of the investors were ever told that these were subprime loans. Further, that Mr. Murray was the first to know about whether a borrower was either in default or a property was foreclosed upon. Further, it was Mr. Murray, just to make another point, who was the leader and organizer, because he created Big State Properties in the late 2000. And that was an organization created primarily to dump, if you will, the default and foreclosed loans into, take them out of the name of Premier, so that the investors would never learn about these defaults. This is the extensive nature of the conduct by Mr. Murray, which makes him a leader organizer, and the court appropriately applied 3B1.1 in the sentence.
Let me ask you one question about one issue raised in the brief was that I think a new guideline was applied before the effective date of that guideline.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I think the new guideline came in on November 1, and the indictment alleged that the conspiracy extended beyond that date. But in brief, the defendant says there's no evidence that the conspiracy did extend beyond that date. What's your answer to that?
My response, Your Honor, is that there was evidence of activity beyond that date. The PSR points out, first of all, that in October, late October, Premier was still sending out letters to investors. And even though Premier had filed bankruptcy on October 1, some conduct continued. Further,
I mean, is there evidence in the record of that, at trial, or what are we talking about?
That's in the PSR, Your Honor, and that was evidence at the trial. I can refer the court to the testimony of some of the victims who testified about their conduct and that of the company after.
It was post-bankruptcy contact?
It was post-bankruptcy, but to please the court, I know you're asking about, was it post-November 1st?
Well, that would also be post-bankruptcy. Bankruptcy was October 1, right?
Correct. That's right, Your Honor. That's right. And the victims testified that they actually called meetings to try to understand what was going on after the company filed for bankruptcy.
What about, was there evidence that Murray participated in any conspiracy, though?
Well, Your Honor, this is our point about that. These meetings, Mr. Murray did not show. And, in fact, the testimony was that he was supposed to have been out of town for a funeral. That was not true. We think that that's evidence of an attempt to conceal on Mr. Murray's part the extent of the fraud and his participation in the fraud.
And that was post-November 1?
We didn't have exact dates in the testimony. I looked at it, what the victim testified about, but they do testify that this was, yes, post the bankruptcy filing, and there were three meetings.
They don't say it's after November 1.
They don't say specifically, Your Honor. That's correct.
Did the PSR make a finding that it was that he did participate after November 1?
Not that specific point. The PSR did make the finding that, as alleged in the indictment, the conspiracy ran through December of 2001, without making a finding as to specific points of conduct of Mr. Murray, per se. That's correct.
Okay.
So I'd like to just briefly come back to the main points the court has inquired about this morning, and that is on the loss figure. There's no question that Mr. Murray was given more than a considerable leniency, if you will, and credit as far as the loss goes. $165 million loss, we stand by. The evidence showed that. The expert found that. He laid it out specifically, that $50 million was giving him, was obtained by the victims who took over the partnerships and actually brought money back into those partnerships. The $17 million, which was $28 million, was hard losses, and the $17 million, which they considered to be probable losses. So all these figures brought the number down to $84 million. And we think that that's more than considerate of the original loss figure, which was $165 million. And again, another important point on that, on the question about the Ponzi scheme, as I indicated, the company was never solvent, that is, as to these loans. And all the loans are made and all the partnerships set up, they all ran a negative balance, if you will, no income during the 3 years that this company was in business. And so, therefore, we think this definitely was a Ponzi scheme.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Ms. Landau.
Beginning with the last issue first, the government needs to do more than just allege that the conspiracy continued sometime beyond the bankruptcy. They have to demonstrate with facts, with evidence, that it went past the effective date of the 2001 amendments, which is November 1st.
We were reviewing that particular issue for plain error, are we not?
Yes, Your Honor. But something that distinguishes this case from other plain error cases about the ex post facto issue is that the judge actually tried to take account of any ex post facto effects and just simply mis-executed. The PSR indicates that in order to account for any ex post facto issues, we will apply the 2001 guidelines, when actually the 2000 guidelines should apply because there's no proof that the conspiracy continued beyond the bankruptcy. This is the first time that the government has asserted that a non-attendance by Mr. Murray at a meeting constitutes fraudulent activity. It's impossible that any fraudulent activity could continue beyond the bankruptcy because the bankruptcy estate had the assets. There were no misrepresentations being made. There were no people being put in investments. It doesn't really add up, the facts, to indicate that the conspiracy continued beyond the bankruptcy date. It kind of strains belief. Next, turning to the leader-organizer enhancement, Mr. Murray doesn't contest the fact that this was a wide-ranging fraud and that he had a high position, nor does Mr. Murray contest that he had responsibilities in the company. But if you read the actual text of the guideline, it's not enough that the fraud was extensive and that Mr. Murray was a bad guy. The government has to show that he actually supervised somebody. And while Mr. Murray had control over the mortgage part, Mr. Lapin had control over the investment part. It was Mr. Lapin who wanted to merge. It was Mr. Lapin who didn't disclose things to the investors. He was in charge of that. It was Mr. Lapin who wanted to continue paying 12% interest when they no longer had the funds to do so. And it was Mr. Lapin who got the bankruptcy underway over Mr. Murray's protest. So it cannot be said that Mr. Murray supervised Mr. Lapin, and by extension, he could not have supervised Mr. Wigington. Even under plain error review, under Ronning, that is not adequate proof of a leader-organizer enhancement. Briefly, as to the amount of loss, the government's position appears to be that Mr. Murray should look at the $84 million as a gift, and that does not square with this court's holdings in Olis or in Goss. That $84 million includes outstanding properties that were later sold, and Mr. Murray did not get credit for those. And the expert didn't find that the amount of loss was 165. He found that it was 84, so the government is not correct in that either. And to say that there was never any legitimate business overlooks 93 different investments that people were invested in. Those were real. There's no real question, even in the government's argument, that those existed. They were misrepresented. That is true. But that doesn't mean they didn't exist or that this is a Ponzi scheme because the business failed. The fact that from an accounting perspective, they didn't make money doesn't mean that it wasn't a legitimate business. And the fact that only 15% of the loans were performing as of the end, doesn't mean it's not a legitimate business either. There's no indication that every single loan was misrepresented. All we know about are the loans that were addressed at trial, and there were many, many more. And lots of loans, if you look at Defendant's Exhibit 1 to the objection to the PSR, at the time of bankruptcy, when those properties were valued, it was thought that they would be all recoverable, or nearly so. So there's clearly a difference of opinion. Simply because the expert said that at trial doesn't mean that it is so. Moreover, contrary to what the government said or kind of implied, Mr. Murray was not on notice that the amount of loss and his entire sentence would be determined by this expert's testimony at trial. Olis pointed this out as a problem when defendants are not put on notice of that. While we were aware, certainly, that he would be testifying, it was not clear that that was going to be the basis for the loss. And in fact, it wasn't even the basis for the loss, because Mr. Arney didn't testify that the loss was $165 million. He said that was the amount of the outstanding loan portfolio at the time of bankruptcy. The court acquiesced in reducing the amount to $84, but that doesn't make it correct, simply because the government agreed to do it and the court agreed because the parties agreed. We have to look at the value of each property at the time of sentencing. Those are properties that are owned by the investors, and they should be given credit.
Okay, thank you very much. We have your case.